have Peter, Peter the Rock, Peter, you know, the one who really was really good at getting stuff started, who really was, in all accounts, pretty faithful. Also, I'm sure this is not a new, well, I'm not sure. It's likely not a new scripture passage for many, most, or all of us. But here's Peter, having walked alongside, having journeyed with Jesus, having watched how Jesus has lived, how he has loved, how he has basically broken or bent most conventions on what it means to be faithfully religious on behalf of a different dynamic, a different way of being outside the norms and the standards and the expectations. And yet, even in this time, after having seen and witnessed all of this, Peter still hasn't completely and fully gotten it. Just before, shortly before this passage, Peter has rightfully declared Jesus as the Messiah. However, Peter still has this expectation that when things get better, it's going to be through the ways of the world. There's still an expectation, I think, among Peter, among many of the disciples, among many of those who are following, who have been beaten down, who aren't liking the way the world is, who are feeling marginalized and even worse. There, I think, is still a hope that things are going to turn around in the conventional ways. Somewhere along the line, Jesus is going to raise up an army. Jesus is going to, all of a sudden, arm his followers. Jesus is going to overthrow the might of Rome with the might of them. Somewhere along the line, they still haven't quite figured it out. When Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan," he isn't calling Peter an evil monster. He's rejecting the temptation to rely on the systems of domination and empire to fix the world. Jesus was continuing to model an upside-down kingdom, if you will. And we, as followers of Jesus, hopefully, if we really are listening, if we really are following, can take that model to challenge the things that are going on in our world today. Not through might, not through exercises of great power, not in the ways of which the world and those who run the world operate. I've heard for so long, and perhaps you have, there certainly are many hymns out there that also, looking at the text, there's this concept of taking up your cross. I have heard it said and explained in so many situations and settings that means no matter what your personal thing is that you're facing, that's your cross. Is it a health issue? Well, then that's your cross to bear. Is it a broken relationship? And while I'm not going to discount that, I am going to invite us to be able to maybe have a slightly different understanding. When Jesus says, "Those who want to follow me, pick up your cross." Because back then, a cross was not a piece of jewelry that we wore around our necks. And it wasn't necessarily even a thing being able to say this particular religion. The cross, when Jesus is talking about picking up your cross and follow me, was a form of execution by Rome for those who were challenging the systems of Rome. So I invite us to hear when Jesus says, if you truly want to follow me, pick up your cross and follow me, Jesus is saying, help change what's going on. Even if it means putting your life at risk for neighbor, friend, perhaps even someone that you do not know. So to take up your cross and to follow him back then, and I would like to say even now, really, while we can say, yes, we are dealing with things, it's much more about where are you putting your allegiance? Where are you placing your trust? Where are you saying, this is how I think the world should and needs to be? And what is it I am willing to do about it? I would venture to say that this particular congregation has experienced the wrath, the consternation, the negative comments and worse, as you have made faithful stances to say you are a community that is inclusive, but much more inclusive, affirming of all God's people. As you fly not only a rainbow flag, but other things around here saying this is a safe space to be, no matter what the larger community, the larger world may say, there is a faithfulness here, and I would say that is taking up your cross and being true to your understanding of the gospel. I lost track. I was watching Keith as he was making posts about how many times a flag out front has been taken, has been trampled, has been taken again, has been done. I don't know what number flag you're on out there. Perhaps you've even lost count. And some people, after a while, may have made the decision that it probably just wasn't worth continuing to put the flag out. And yet the faithfulness in the response was, we're not going to allow forces of hatred and ignorance to diminish who we are and who we say we follow. So my personal words of appreciation for being a church not only named Grace, but truly being a church of Grace. Now I want to tap into, just for a few minutes, this book I keep talking about, If God is Love, Rediscovering Grace in an Ungracious World, because how did we get to the point? How do we get to the point where there is so much hatred in this world? Even more so, how did we get to the point of those within Christianity with having opposing views seem to be at odds so much with one another that we hurl names and we make insults and even far worse? Mulholland and Gully, in the third chapter of this book, sort of pose that there seems to be, are you driven by a theology of hate or a theology of love? They pose a question, how did the followers of one who considered being persecuted a blessing eventually bless the persecution of others? How was the church able to diminish, if not dismiss, the command to love our enemies? And I would venture a guess, as do they, that it comes to the rising of power and acceptability of Christianity. You see, prior to rising in power, the church really had no recourse other than grace. The church on its early on was on the margins. Troublemakers, if you will, because kept insisting on the world isn't right the way it is. But there was no legitimacy in the eyes of the government and those ruling in Rome and in other places. And so grace prevailed as a way of not getting so frustrated and angry to take it out on those who were hurting and abusing. The early church, it seems, was committed to pacifism and acceptance of others who had also been ostracized, and it's willing to die as Jesus invites, rather than betray the faith. In fact, the word martyr comes from the Greek word, which means to give witness. The early followers of Jesus gave witness to grace. But what happens when the oppressed gain power? Lord Acton in 1887 penned a letter to a bishop in which he famously is quoted for stating that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think a lot of this started to happen in about 312 with the conversion of Constantine in this raging of wars back then. And all of a sudden, Constantine saw, I'm going to be a skeptic, I'm going to be a cynic. And I think it was done for political reasons other than what we've been taught. But decided that he needed more people, and therefore he needed to gather people to support his sake. So let's legitimize this strange following of people and gather them up and say that they're doing God's work in this area. I think it started to continue to go downhill from then. A few weeks ago, when I was here, I shared my childhood experience of participating in a neighborhood good news club designed to incentivize and to evangelize kids into coming to Christ. If you weren't here, we had buckets that you could reach in, and if you were there, you got to pick out a prize simply for being in attendance. And if you remembered the Bible verse that you were told to memorize for the week, you got another prize. And if you brought somebody to Good News Club, there was another bucket with even cooler prizes. Sounds innocent enough, kind of, sort of. The authors of this book had a similar experience, although they experienced something called Christian Youth Crusaders. They reflected it met in the basement of the church every Wednesday night to sing songs, to memorize verses, and to earn badges. Man, we never got badges in Good News Club. Badges sound pretty cool. Got those in Boy Scouts. And they shared that one of the favorite songs that they sang was, and I don't know the tune to this, so I'm not even going to attempt it. Some of it might even be familiar to you. I may never fight in the infantry, ride in the cavalry, shoot the artillery. I may never fly over the enemy, but I'm in the Lord's army. Kind of reminds me of when I was growing up, one of my very favorite hymns that I now pretty much refuse to sing, Onward, Christian Soldiers. They were taught to put on the full armor of God. They held weekly called sword drills, where points were earned for finding a particular verse in the Bible before anybody else in the room could do that. They shared that the church seemed as if it was training small children for battle. Instead of critiquing the behavior of the Christian crusaders, the church claimed them as heroes. Even the Bible became a weapon, a sword to wield against enemies. I have to imagine growing up with a theology that defended both the violence of God and the intolerance of God's people, it sort of lays some early foundation. We can try to argue that religious hatred and violence are sins of the past. But to do so, we must ignore many of the current Christian visions of the future. Left behind books and movies. The fixation of Jesus being displayed on flags carrying assault weapons. Sometimes even riding an American bald eagle alongside prominent politicians. very much an us versus them motif, an understanding of divide and conquer and conquer and conquer. The authors go on to share, for many, it seems that the world is divided into three categories of people: the saved, the unsaved, and the wicked. The saved, well, they're the ones that share our doctrines, our beliefs, our understanding. They're our inner circle. The unsaved are those ones that, if we can just teach them the right way of being, understanding things, well, the way we understand them, of singing the songs that we sing, we can gather them in and we can save the unsaved. Well, the wicked are those that we can search in the Bible or elsewhere, and somehow there's just no chance for them. But here's the thing. When we start dividing people into categories, it also helps us try to decide if we want to spend our time caring for them, listening to them, loving them. When we start putting names and categories to people, and this is as much on one side as the other, I am as guilty as anybody else, it's easy to begin to depersonalize them. Early experiences in Army basic training, I know, you're going to get Army stories from me, 25 years, they're just all in there. Once in a while, they come rolling out. Early on in basic training, running miles upon miles, you would do something called a singing cadence. They were words that we would all be singing. Somebody would say words, and then the rest of us would echo it. It would take our minds off of the grueling pace and distance that we were running. It would get our voices in sync, and it made us become one. Some very silly ones, some very spicy ones. I'm not going to sing any of them. But the most disturbing one to me is I was back in there in the early 80s. We weren't that far removed from Vietnam. And there were a lot of cadences that were taking folks that were of Asian descent, Vietnamese descent, and putting words to them that were just awful. The things that we were training to do to them, absolutely awful and horrific. And if you get exposed to that long enough, you begin to dehumanize them. Decades later, it would become the same thing for folks of Middle Eastern descent, as we had folks in training reacting to events of 9/11 or anything else. Anytime we begin to characterize people in negative stereotypes for whatever reason, it makes it much easier for us to not have to care for them, listen to them, love them. That's the theology of hate and division. If we flip that, a theology of love says, regardless of who someone is, regardless of what they say, believe, look like, act like, I will get to know them. I may not agree with them, but I will see them as God's created. And once I acknowledge that that person is equal in God's sight as I am, I can no longer hate them. I can no longer do a number of atrocious things. Now, this is where I say I struggle as much as the next person. I am great at connecting with folks of different faith traditions. I will sit there and have lunch and coffee with anybody from an Islamic tradition or a Buddhist tradition or a Jewish tradition. You get me up against more fundamental Christians and I struggle. Perhaps that's because it's so close to what I think we're supposed to believe following Jesus that it feels like, and I'm going to choose my words carefully and not go where I want, 25 years in the army, there's some language in here that probably wouldn't be polite to share in this context. But if I'm real with myself, I need to spend as much time having coffee with, sitting down with, listening to, trying to hear out those who think very differently than me, that also claim to follow Jesus the Christ. Moment of confession, I need to learn to become more gracious. Perhaps I'm looking at a room that you guys aren't there, and thank God if you're not. But the invitation is for each of us. No matter how much like Peter we are, with our own understanding of the way the world is supposed to be, how the world is going to change, how many parades, how many movements, how many letters, how many elections. Perhaps the way the world truly changes is when we sit down, look at those who are so different than us. Not categorize them. Not name call them. Not have a number of very bad thoughts that we want to see happen to them. But truly see them also as God's beloved. My friends, my invitation for myself more than anything else is to learn to become more gracious in this very ungracious world. We have a word of prayer with me. Dear God, continue to lead us and to guide us. Help this community continue to be that light and beacon in this community that says they are not only in name but in deed a place of grace, where all will be loved. Not necessarily all bad behaviors, but all people will be seen as your children. Amen. Returning to this morning's children's message. While life is certainly not a game, it doesn't mean it shouldn't be enjoyed, friends. But how we find that enjoyment, that fulfillment, that sense of purpose which brings purpose, is in whose ways we choose to follow. So let's move forward together in participating not in what Simon says, what empire says, but simply in what Jesus says. I invite you to join in response with me, number 314.